traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Hello, I'm Matthew Valencia, Special Assignments Editor, and you're listening to Money Talks. And on this show, as the Olympics play out in Rio, Soumaya Keynes is here to tell us how countries can go for the gold.
If you're choosing where to throw your money, you maybe don't want to go for football, which only has, you know, one medal or two. You really want to go for things like cycling or gymnastics, where there are lots and lots of medals to be won.
And our finance correspondent, Krista Coscello, talks about the burgeoning distressed debt market.
So the NPL market is growing significantly in Europe, and the sort of specialized market players are very bullish about it growing further.
But first, there are currently around 500 scripted shows on television. Do we need that many? How much TV is too much?
There's this other notion that you reach something called the paradox of choice, which is you give people too many choices and it breeds discontent, because ultimately it's very hard to pay attention to all the choices. It becomes work, essentially, to sort through everything, every opportunity you're giving them.
That's John Landgraf, president of FX Network, at the Edinburgh International Television Festival.
And ultimately, I think all businesses, all industries basically go through, they overexpand and then they consolidate. And all I can say is that in my view, I think that less would be more. I think a few, 300 television shows would be better than 500 television shows. And
according to Mr. Landgraf, the industry's insatiable appetite for shows will bring about its own demise.
I see business kind of eating the creative tail right now. There's a feeding frenzy. There's a sense of great amounts of money to be made.
Well, with me on the line now to discuss so-called peak TV and the rise of Netflix is Gaddy Epstein, our media editor. Gaddy, let's first start with Mr. Landgraf himself. It's clear he's caused a stir among executives and in the press. How big a player is he?
Well, he's a big player. He makes some of the best TV there is out there. He's a very well respected in the industry and by critics. Some call him the mayor of TV or the smartest man in TV. He is taken quite seriously, and he has kind of a professorial air about him. So when he gets going on these topics, he can really deliver a lecture, as he has here.
Right, and what do you make of his assessment of the television industry today? I mean, is it true that there are simply too many shows?
I don't think there are. I do think that there's too many shows for us all to digest, or for any one of us to digest. But I'm not too worried about peak TV. I think in general, the heavy investment in television in the last few years has increased competition, raised the standards. I mean, let's face it, TV didn't used to be all that great. And now, I think, starting with HBO and then with channels like FX that all compete for subscribers and affiliate fees, and now with Netflix, which is also subscription-based, and Amazon, I think the measure of what to put on television is much more towards quality than towards sort of broader ratings-based or advertising-based fare.
With only so many hours in the day, and most of us spending much of our time doing other things in work or at school or wherever, how can there really be room for more television in our lives?
Well, I mean, there's also the question of which segment of the market is being addressed by which shows. There's not all the shows are being made for you or me. There's shows being made for everyone. And I think that is the argument that, you know, folks like Netflix would make, is that prestige television like HBO and FX offer appeals to one market segment, whereas there's plenty of other people out there, whether it's, you know, children and teenagers or people in different countries who have different tastes who are looking for other kinds of television. So everybody likes quality TV, but also people like broader fare as well.
Okay, so let's now move on to Netflix. Is it a monopolist or a potential monopolist, as Mr. Landgraf says?
I'm not too worried about Netflix becoming a monopoly. First of all, they have very strong competition. Amazon, perhaps their biggest threat, is very well-funded. They've just announced a big increase in their investment in content, And of course, they're not looking to make money only from video, far from it. And then there's plenty of other competitors. There's Hulu in the U.S. There's YouTube globally. There are streaming services around the world. Major Hollywood studios themselves, some of them will go direct to consumer with their own streaming services. So there's a lot of competition for Netflix. Second, the barriers is pretty low for new players to get content in some viewable form online, I think lower than ever. There's always the chance of new players breaking out. And then third, I think the risk is low because quality content is differentiated and people place a value on it. You can't just industrialize storytelling. And John Landgraf likes to say that you can't make stories like you make jet engines. And I think that's true, but I think that's also why we have nothing to fear.
So it seems from what Mr. Landgraf is saying that he and some others seem to believe that the industry is sowing the seeds of its own demise. Others seem to be arguing that that it's entering a new golden era. What do you think?
I'm more inclined to think that we're entering an era where TV is getting better and better. Production values are better. The competition to make great TV has never been greater. There's no sign of overall investment declining. Now, there might be a time where we do reach peak TV and we have fewer shows being made than we have now. But that doesn't mean, even Mr. Landgraf acknowledges, that doesn't mean we're going to have a sudden bursting of a bubble. We'll have maybe just some fewer shows. Meanwhile, I think the overall standard has been raised. And I think the benchmark for making TV has been, can you win passionate subscribers? Can you win passionate viewers? And I think that's only good for quality of what we see.
And so, Gadi, out of the hundreds of shows that are being produced and worked on, which have caught your attention? Which do you think are most noteworthy?
Well, I'm a big fan of the shows on Landgraf's network, FX. I'm caught up on The Americans. I loved the second year of Fargo. I have seen a couple episodes of an upcoming show, Atlanta, on FX that I think people are going to love. They're making terrific television. Also watching a good bit of Netflix last week. I'm in Europe reporting on Netflix, and to recover from jet lag last week, I binge-watched Stranger Things and really enjoyed that.
Gadi Epstein, thank you very much.
Thank you, Matthew.
And to our listeners, if you have any thoughts on peak TV, let us know. Tweet us at Economist Radio or email us at radio@economist.com. Now we move on to the Olympics, which have, of course, been taking place in Rio de Janeiro over the past fortnight. Just what does it take to achieve glory? Sumaya Keynes, our economics correspondent, has been looking into the data. Sumaya, welcome.
Hello.
What strategies work for countries looking to increase their medal count?
Well, it really helps if you are a big, rich country with a huge, huge population, so you can, you know, you have lots of people to draw your winning athletes from. But there are some more specific things you can do. Essentially, you really need to throw a lot of money at it. You could also pick your sport strategically, right? So if you're choosing where to throw your money, you maybe don't want to go for football, which only has, you know, one medal or two. You really want to go for things like cycling or gymnastics, where there are lots and lots of medals to be won.
And so if we look at the medal table as it stands now, Britain is in second place after the United States with 16 gold medals, a tally that may well be even higher by the time our listeners hear this. This is pretty shocking, given that Britain never used to do well at the Olympics. It only got one gold medal at the 96 Atlanta Games, for instance. What's it done to increase its count?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty amazing turnaround. And the answer really is money. So under John Major, they threw a huge, huge amount of funding at the challenge. And essentially that money seems to be paying off. Also, there was another huge batch of funding after London won the right to host the Olympics in 2012. So the other thing is that Britain has done, it's not just the amount of money, right? It's how it's targeted and how it responds to events. So in Britain, there's been this kind of fairly ruthless targeting of funding towards the sports that people thought would do well.
Are there any particular sports that they've focused on there?
Right. So cycling, obviously, has been a big one. For a poorer country, it's much harder to invest in the infrastructure. So, you know, Britain had the advantage that it could get above that hurdle to kind of do well in the cycling. The key thing, though, that Britain's done is it's been responsive, right? So when a team didn't do as well in a particular sport, the funding was cut and reallocated towards sports that did kind of exceed the medal count. So for cycling, when the British team got 12 medals in 2012, its funding increased by about £4 million from about £26 million.
Right, and there were a lot of people cheering on Monday evening when Thiago da Silva won Brazil's second gold medal of the Games in the pole vault. We've talked about Britain and its uplifting experience with the Games. How have other countries tried to get more gold medals?
So it's really fun to look around and see what the different countries try. So this strategy of kind of sending the funding towards people who are likely to do well seems to be fairly common. So in Canada, there's this kind of on-the-podium strategy that they tried after they hosted the Olympics twice and won no gold medals. The other thing is you can award cash prizes for getting a gold medal. So in Singapore, apparently they're offering $753,000 for a gold medal and $230,000 in Kazakhstan. The US only offers kind of around $25,000 for a gold medal. But it's kind of amazing because Britain doesn't offer anything like that.
So they just have to make do with the joy of winning a gold medal, which I'm sure is enough for most of them.
But. Yeah, I mean, so Britain's approach is, I think, to kind of, you know, give out that money before you win the medal. So if you're kind of particularly promising in Britain, then you get paid, I think, £28,000 to live on. I haven't actually come across kind of hard evidence on whether this works, but if you were going to direct the funding at any point, then you really want to do it before they win the gold medal. I think at that level of athletics, the idea that, you know, Usain Bolt is really being motivated to run that, you know, millisecond faster because of the cash prize just kind of seems a bit unreasonable. I think really probably a much, much more important determinant of success is the amount of support you get before you actually get to the Games.
And do we know anything about which strategies work in terms of creating sustainable success?
Again, kind of hard economic evidence on this is fairly scarce, but just looking, if you compare kind of Canada and Great Britain, it does seem like when you direct the funding, you really want to focus on the sport as a whole rather than individuals within that sport. So Canada's focused on promoting individuals with promise, and some people are kind of, they're worried that as those individuals age out of the system, that's not going to kind of lead to long-term medal counts.
Sumaya Keynes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Last, we move on to Italy's ailing banks. A few weeks ago, we described the growing troubles of Italy's financial sector as the new Brexit, in other words, a national crisis with far-reaching implications. EU rules require bail-in plans, which involve forcing bondholders to take the pain and recapitalise banks, rather than bailouts, which put the burden on taxpayers. Another solution has been offered, selling off huge stocks of banks' non-performing loans. Krista Cascello, our finance correspondent, is here with me now. Krista, could you first give us a primer on what non-performing loans, or NPLs as they're alternatively known, are?
Finance loves to retreat into jargon, but actually we need to remember that NPLs are actually a homeowner who can't make their mortgage payments, who maybe lost a job, or a small business owner who, you know, is selling some sort of product, but then recession came and the sales dropped. So the NPLs are a very heterogeneous category of sort of consumer loans, mortgage loans, SME loans. These are people who took out loans for specific purposes and now no longer can pay them back. Sometimes they pledged collateral to sort of guarantee the loan principal, and sometimes they didn't, depending on the circumstance.
And how developed or well-functioning is the market for non-performing loans in Europe?
This market has grown quite strongly. So last year, sales were about 100 billion euros in Europe. And this year, sales are already above that, around 110 billion for just the first half of this year alone. So the NPL market is growing significantly in Europe. And the sort of specialized market players are very bullish about it growing further.
Right. So you've been having some interesting discussions with players in the distressed debt markets. What exactly are they saying?
I expected going in that these specialized players like Apollo, Cerberus, Lone Star, there's sort of a handful of American funds, that they would be talking about the loan portfolios. But actually, they cared a lot about bank capital needs. And I spoke with Apollo's head of Europe, who told me that basically the NPL market is even from their perspective, driven by banks' capital needs. So they speak with banks to sort of look into how they can best help banks sort of thicken their capital buffers. And in, many of these firms actually sort of, even if they have mostly buy up distressed debt, they also have private equity arms. So sometimes they offer to actually do some recapitalization of the banks themselves or to buy off sort of businesses from banks. So often loan servicing businesses is particularly popular because these NPLs, you know, need a lot of active involvement. A loan servicer is essentially just the company who either calls up debtors to sort of pressure them to pay or to agree a sort of new rescheduled payment, or, you know, who actually initiate the judicial process to recover collateral if they have pledged collateral. And so it often makes sense for the distressed debt investors to buy these loan servicing units off banks or just other business areas like an insurance company that was a division of a bank.
So obviously Italy's troubled banks are the focus at the moment. But what do the experiences of other countries tell us about how this can be done? And indeed, what the barriers are to doing it.
So I think that the experience of a lot of other countries shows that a huge pileup of non-performing loans can only really be dealt with pretty heavy-handed government involvement. So historically, many countries have set up bad banks. So sort of the government actually sets up a pot of money that buys off these non-performing loans from banks close to their written down book value and then slowly sells them off or actually tries to do the loan recovery themselves.
Where have we seen that?
In Europe, we've seen that recently in Spain and Ireland, although Italy is not allowed to set up a bad bank now that EU rules have recently been toughened. So Italy is in that sense in a very tight spot, and the securitization law is in some sense a response to try to address that. Earlier on, these sorts of bad banks were very successful, for example, in the East Asian financial crisis in Japan and Korea around the late 1990s. So they've provided a way of also getting a lot of volume. So in Italy, for example, all the banks are really small. So each of them individually has a sort of small pot of loans, whereas if they were put in one centralized organ that then sort of deals with them centrally and sells them off centrally, that also makes it much easier for there to be a flourishing market in these NPLs rather than each little bank selling off just a small bunch of loans at a time.
Krista Cascello, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for this episode of Money Talks. To read more about non-performing loans, pick up the upcoming issue of The Economist or visit our website at economist.com. I'm Matthew Valencia. Thanks for joining us. Goodbye.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.